Welcome. Today is one of our three times of the year when people can join our year-long practice program called Warming the Hearth. And I just want to acknowledge the joining of a few new people who aren't here because at least all the confirmed people all live out of town. Maybe the way of the modern Dharma world is that this program is one where you can participate online, video meetings and video dokusan, and listening to talks and from the website and so on. So. Also, maybe some of you old-timers know some of these people. Lori Chambers. Yeah. Apparently, she said she used to live next door. Yeah, and practice with Catherine. And I don't know where she lives now, but out of town. Los Gatos.
She comes occasionally.
Oh, okay. So, so she's joining. Another one, Gustavo Rivera.
Oh, you're kidding! Oh, my God, Gustavo!
Gustavo lives in Miami.
Oh.
He says, say hi to you and Patrick. And,
yeah,
He threw up at his first Oreo
piece.
He ate the setsu steak.
The setsu steak did it mean, huh? That's good.
That's a funny thing to be remembered by.
Well, Gustavo, if you're listening to this talk, welcome back. And Lori and Bob McCreary are a couple who live in the East Bay who I met at the Tassajara Study Week last year, and they've been staying in touch online and are joining for a year. And then a couple others who haven't gotten back to me, so I won't say. Yeah, so he's one who
came by and said hi this evening and said he has to study for midterms, that he said he was joining.
Oh, he is. Okay, Andrew Porter.
Yeah.
Andrew Porter, I was thinking about it, so it sounds like maybe he is joining Warming the Hearth. And Val is another one. Val, who lives in Santa Cruz. Val Miranda.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so, so she maybe too. So it goes on, and we're studying the Song of the Trusting Mind for now. And ways for people to tap into Sangha, even if they can't actually make it in person. I think it's good. It's nice to come in person, and I think some of these people want to come to maybe one-day sittings and things like that. But they can connect from afar also. So that begins today, another year of warming the hearth at Warm Jewel Temple. Dogen Zenji, our ancestor, has a essay called The Buddha Way. And I think most of you probably know this story of this word Buddha. I don't know if this is the first time it was ever used, but there's one story in the tradition that shortly after that person's awakening, he was walking around and kind of radiating, glowing with the light of wisdom and compassion. And somebody saw him walking down the road and said, "Excuse me, sir, like, who are you? You seem like more glowing than a usual human, but like, you know, gods don't usually appear like this on the road. So are you a god or a human or what?" And he said, "I am Buddha." And so it wasn't so much like a name or a title. It just means awake. Right? So then we like to leave it untranslated. Buddha, because it has a nice ring, Buddha. But we could hear it as he just said, I'm not going to say I'm a human or a god, I'm just going to say I'm awake, or I'm an awakened one. So this translation says, this essay is called The Buddha Way, but maybe more pertinent to what Dogen is saying in here, we could call it The Awake Way, or The Awakened Way, this essay. It's a long number of pages, but here's some excerpts. Dogen says, when the world honored one, another name for the awakened one, was alive, he did not call his teaching the Buddha school. He didn't say, I'm starting the Buddha school now. Or even the Vulture Peak School, where the first entrustment of his Dharma to his student Mahakashyapa happened, or the Jeta Grove School, one of the places he practiced. He did not call it My Mind School, or the Buddha Mind School. He wouldn't say like the Buddha Mind, because he's talking about he is the Buddha, so. I think it's kind of funny that Dogen says he didn't call it My Mind School. My Mind as the Buddha, or the Buddha Mind School. In which discourses did he call it the Buddha Mind School? Why then do people nowadays call it Buddha Mind School? For what reason would the world-honored one name the teaching after his mind? And then Dogen says, for us later students to mistakenly use the name Zen school, the Zenshu, is to damage the gate of the Buddhas and ancestors, and is not permitted by Buddhas and ancestors. It makes you think that there's a teaching called the Zen school besides the teaching of Buddhas and ancestors. This is the erroneous way outside the teaching of Buddhas and ancestors. You who are descendants of Buddhas and ancestors should rely on the bones, marrow, and face of Buddhas and ancestors. Throw yourself into the way of Buddhas and ancestors. Do not deviate from this and study outside the way, the awakened way. That you have a human body and mind is a rare thing, which is the result of endeavor in the way from olden times. Receiving this gracious result, do not mistakenly become a student outside the awakened way. It's not returning gratitude to the Buddhas and ancestors. And then even within this Zen, this name, Zen school arose before Dogen's time. And he said, we really shouldn't say that. And then within that Zen school, there were these five different schools of Zen, and Dogen critiques that too, and you can't make these distinctions. Dogen says, people who study scriptures in China tend to talk about schools because they like to make comparisons among them. But the treasury of the true Dharma eye of Buddhas and ancestors has been entrusted from heir to heir. There's no way to compare it, and there's nothing it can be confused with. However, careless elders of the present day groundlessly use the names of these schools in an attempt to establish themselves without being concerned with the Buddha way. The Buddha way is not their Buddha way. It's the Buddha way of all Buddhas and ancestors. It's the Buddha way of the Buddha way. If there were to be a name of the school, the world-honored one would have used it himself. But he didn't. The only wishes of the world-honored one's disciples who were left behind were not to vary one hair's breadth from how he was when he was alive in the world. In this way, vow to see and meet the awakened one, birth after birth, and hear that teaching. So, sometimes Dogen tends to be like critical of other ways. But in this essay, he goes on for many pages, and what I kind of hear is like the teaching of non-sectarianism. Not even to say it's the Zen school, he's saying we shouldn't really say it. And of course, his later disciples said it, and we still say it, and we'll probably say it again. It's okay, but Dogen brings up this point, not falling into a kind of narrow version of our way. And I think it's a tricky area, right? Because we have all this stuff that's like all these robes and ornaments and particular ways of doing things, right? That are different from other disciples of the Buddha, of the awakened one. But I hear this as the spirit of all the students of the awakened one. Are all one family. I remember once actually I was practicing in Thailand for a short time out of one of the forest monasteries, and we went to visit an elder monk at a different monastery, and I had my black Zen robes which stood out in sharp contrast to the more like ochre robes of the forest monks. And we went to visit this teacher who, rumor had it, was like one of the few arhats living in the world. Very old, he was in a wheelchair. And of course he spoke no English, but we sat down, he gave some kind of talk, and he gestured to me and asked some question which I didn't know, and they translated it, or maybe they said he's a Zen person, something like that. It's another way of the Buddha. And this teacher said, kind of bowed or something, and said, all one family of Buddha. And it really stuck with me. I really appreciated that. And in a tradition that can also be kind of narrow-minded. Whenever we practice a certain way, it's hard. We're invested in it, right? So it's hard not to think that it's the way or the best way. Very hard, I think, to really feel like, well, it's all equal and I just happen to be doing this this way. I think it's kind of unlikely, actually. It's not like we just happen to, really. We're kind of choosing a particular way. So I think this is a challenging practice. And just one more story about this kind of spirit I found on Kuke.com, David Chadwick's website. So an old student of Suzuki Roshi remembers this story. Actually, this is about Katagiri Roshi from the old days at San Francisco Zen Center. This is an anecdote of Frank Anderton, who, I don't know. Somebody from the old days, and he said, I remember going to a Dharma talk that Katagiri gave in the Buddha Hall one cool, dark evening in San Francisco. About 5 or 10 minutes into the talk, a young man came into the hall and sat down on a cushion and listened, looking somewhat ill at ease. Near the end of the talk, the young man said, I just want to say something. I've heard a lot of talk this evening, and I've listened to everything you've had to say, but I haven't heard anything about the Bible or God or anything about Jesus, and you're missing the point without Jesus. Katagiri listened quietly and soberly. He waited a moment and then said, those are good words, interesting words, but you haven't said anything about practice. It's good to have a car, a vehicle, but if you don't have any gas in the car, it won't go. So where's your gas? Or what's your gas? And the young man repeated his words about Jesus and said, and that's all I've got to say. He concluded, and then he jumped up and ran out of the Buddha hall. And Katagiri smiled while we all sat there quiet as church mice. I didn't consider myself a Christian, but I was very impressed at how much courage and maybe presumption it must have taken to come into Zen Center alone and say what he said. I wish he had stayed. So, another story about how we can think of like, identify with a kind of way, or principles or teachings of a certain spiritual tradition, and forget about what's the practice of being awake that can go beyond the division of different schools and traditions. Dogen didn't go so far as to say all religions are the same, and I don't know, maybe somebody should have pressed him on that. Maybe he didn't know of many others, actually, except maybe Shinto, Taoism, Confucianism. But the awakened way that that has particular forms and styles, but is not like limited to any particular fixed way. Awakening is the criterion. So more could be said, but I remember in past talks, I go past the time limit, going on, and lose track, talking and talking away, and leave no time for any discussion. So it's quite early, probably. Sweet. So that's just some thoughts about the awakened way. But if anyone has anything about any topic to bring up at all, please bring it forth. Yes?
Well, since you opened the door, some of us have been talking about, we've been kind of adding in some practice from Reggie Ray and body awareness. And, you know, I have been finding it to absolutely be supporting my zazen. I mean, doing this sashimi with a couple of those real specific practices, they're not fancy. It's just, you know, kind of putting your awareness into different parts of your body,
yeah,
being aware of the body. And it was so helpful. And I couldn't help but have this thought of, God, I wish somebody had taught this to me when I started practicing, you know, 30 years ago or whatever it was, because I am a person who's had a difficult time with zazen. Not everybody does, but I have. And I kept doing it because I've always felt it was valuable. But it was really, I remember too that sashimi you taught some years ago where you taught us about those six gates.
Mm-hmm.
And almost apologetically, I remember you said, gee, I really, you know, I'm really not supposed to do this because it's not really Zen. But it's really helpful. And I love those. And I use those gates up at Tassajara. So it's kind of a funny feeling where on the one hand, wanting to honor the particularity of the form, because if it's all just smushed together, then we lose something.
Yeah.
There is something in the particularity of what we do.
Yeah.
And yet, I feel like it's very important to not be closed to opening to things that can be helpful. Though I've heard that criticized. I know at Kasapara this last fall when Abbas Lerner was teaching about the body practice. It was she who recommended the book to me. She was criticized quite strongly by some of the younger monks that this is not Zen, and this is the end of Zen in the West. This is exactly, you know, this is what's going to pollute the Dharma in the West, is exactly this kind of mishmash. I just want to bring that forward. I know some of us are kind of working with this.
It's tricky. I think it was tricky in Dogen's time because there were different traditions outside of so-called Zen. But now we really have the whole range in America, right? So many spiritual paths. And the Bodhisattva's spirit is what's helpful for awakening, what's beneficial and helpful without being stuck in any limited ideas. And yet, just like you say, it's like What do we offer at a particular place like this? And there's all so many different places too, practice places that are much more eclectic. And I know this comes up in our practice committee meetings a lot. People offer to do a workshop or some event in some topic, and we say, is this in accord with what we're doing here? And I confess, I tend to fall more on the side of like, well, if it's helpful, does it have to be Zen? And yet, then we could end up doing a lot of different events. So, it's an open question. Any other thoughts? Yes.
I remember practicing in Sydney sometime many years ago, and we couldn't do Orioki in Zendo. We had to do it sitting at tables and chairs. And I kind of got really upset. I felt like we're going to lose some of the form if we have to sit at tables and chairs. And I said that to my teacher. And I just remember how she was so clear that we don't have to worry about losing the form, that people just embody it and they pass it on and they keep doing it and it's robust and then just don't worry about it. It was really nice. It just gave me a sense of trusting that we have to be thoughtful but not overly worried that everything's going to disintegrate the minute somebody says something about something else. That we're the ones that are holding the form in our bodies and in our community, and it just keeps going. I mean, it seems to keep going.
And it naturally keeps evolving, because it's a little bit funny because we say, well, we have to practice Dogen Soto Zen way, but of course that's very different from the Buddha's way. So if everybody said, we're just going to practice exactly like Shakyamuni, the awakened one in India, there wouldn't be so-called Zen anyway. So how does it evolve in an authentic way, though? How does it, and that's what I think Dogen's emphasizing throughout here is, he's saying it's not just kind of randomly wallowing around in the waves, but actually based on like the Buddha's awakening. And it came up in a talk a few weeks ago. I remember Nanette brought up this question, something like, well, awakening isn't limited to Buddhism, right? There's all these people in many traditions. And that question really stayed with me, actually, because I thought, well, I wonder about that. Definitely great compassion and wisdom pervades all these spiritual traditions, but is it the same as the Buddha's awakening or not? You know, that's a big topic. I won't say one way or the other, but there may be these differences in the end. You know, particularly when she brought that up, I was kind of running through, well, is it the same? And I thought of, emptiness, you know, these emptiness teachings. I think we can find similar teachings in other traditions, but I think there's something, that's one of the aspects that's pretty unique, I think, to the awakened one's dharma from old India, the teachings of no independent self and the emptiness of all dharmas. At least in a really explicit way. And that's kind of almost like the content of the Buddha's awakening. So that might be an interesting thing to say. Can we find that same ungraspability in Taoism? Yes.
What comes to mind is the uncraftability in these different traditions would need to be experienced, because then you know you're actually just really using a labor, and from that labor you can then compare labors with other people, and so it kind of disheartening for us beginners, because it's like, oh my God, I always have to be in the enlightened state in order to make all the decisions about my life, but I'm actually not, because I'm a total beginner. I don't know what's, you know, black and what's white. And so it can be disheartening. The other side can also be totally encouraging, because these forms or these labels are to be compared. The fact that they're different schools is there. Too lazy. Oh, I'm expecting like this, you're expecting like this, you know. What's the difference? You know, what's the difference if I'm embodying this one, embodying this, how does it feel, you know? And slowly, slowly keep going with what's more opening and softening. I guess that's maybe like the light, like running theme of what's like more, what's leading to more openness and softness, you know, softening the heart, being kindly, being ethical.
Openness and softness, and within, you know, within this particular tradition that we sometimes defile by calling it Buddha Dharma as a specific thing, I think, you know, there's certain kinds of languages within that that you can compare these different views more easily. And then when you get more into the interfaith dialogue with completely different traditions, the problem, just like you say, is you're using these designations, and people use different designations to talk about the same thing. The language can be so different. So I think it is very hard to compare without the direct experience. But then if you have these two people with direct experience, how are you going to talk about it, right? They're going to use this language, and oh no, we're definitely not having the same experience. But maybe they are, right? They just have different language. So that's tricky too. And even within Buddha Dharma, like I think of that story at some kind of inter-denominational Buddhist gathering when there was a Tibetan teacher and a Korean Zen teacher just talking during one of the breaks, and the Korean teacher held up an apple. And in classic Zen sort of koan style said, "What is this?" And the Tibetan teacher is kind of talking with his translator and trying to discern what was going on. And the translator said something like, "Oh, you mean, do you not have apples in your country?" So it's like, even within Buddha Dharma, the languages sometimes form this kind of barrier. We can't communicate. Maybe same experience, right? But the Zen people are kind of weird, the way they express stuff. But Dean.
So this comment comes out of my teaching in a different kind of place, which is the work I do on campus. And working with students about the question of when to be eclectic in their thinking and writing, and when to stick with the line. And usually what I think of, I mean, sometimes we want to jump from tradition to tradition or to embrace eclecticism because it gives us a new challenge and a new way to grow. But sometimes we might want to do it because we want to avoid a challenge. It might be that, like, well, Zen would like me to think about this issue I'm facing in this way. I don't want to do it that way. That'll be too hard for me. I like this other one instead. And then it can become smorgasbordy, is how I describe it. So, or sometimes it really is that I have this way of this philosophy I'm working with, this thinker, this thought, and to draw on something that complements it or even contrasts with it in a certain way challenges me in a new way, to grow in a new way. And so I think that's always the part of the challenge for us if we want to draw on eclectic modes of thinking, is to be sure that we are not, that we're continuing to grow and challenge ourselves and not to avoid insights that are already.
Mix and match style. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also recall Thich Nhat Hanh, as I understand, asks the monks practicing with him, who he wants them to study a lot of particular traditional dharma, and just so they're all steeped in these various sutras and so on. And he says something like, "Why during these first years of practice, maybe 10 years or something, don't study any other religious traditions. But then, just to get really, really steeped in your particular understanding like this, and then it's actually really good, almost like you almost have to then start bringing in the other things later." So it kind of includes both. And that way, I think he even puts it like, then you don't get confused from the beginning you're trying to do this mix and match thing. But if you really understand this teaching completely, then you can compare and contrast, and I think things like interfaith dialogue become more vital and interesting when people are really steeped in their own tradition. Who was it who... Somebody just saying something about interfaith... Was it Joan? Did you say something about interfaith? There was something... If you're in your interfaith, the problem with interfaith dialogues is that people tend to not dilute their own tradition, right?
Opening too wide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, almost like...
To not dilute your own, that's not an offering. That's not expecting anybody to dilute your own.
Yeah.
The problem, I think, is how to uphold a particular tradition without following the dogma.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Being a Zen center in an Episcopal church.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, wholeheartedly... uphold without getting stuck. Yeah, yeah. Yes, Patrick.
Well, I mean, for those of us who, you know, study the Dharma largely in this room, we really have gratitude for this era of Suzuki Roshi and Kōbun Shinrō
Category.
And of course, Catherine. And, you know, just, you know, the two generations who have been here and have kept the practice going for these 40 years have, you know, pretty much done this simple sitting practice. And so it's easy to see why, or to, easy to make the extension of the way Dogen said that. This is the practice of Buddhas and ancestors, because, you know, we can only kind of see it right here in two generations, and, you know, especially with people like Ellen around, you know, from the older from the generation before us, you know, we see that real continuity of practice, and so we have that gratitude for many generations in practice. But that being said, you know, Catherine would give lectures out of interesting articles in the New Yorker, and you know, ask us to look at it, you know, that way. And yet, you know, she saw that the practice that she brought here directly from Asahara, a lot of it wasn't working.
Yeah. Yeah, and how other traditions, possibly the New Yorker, could help us understand our own more. Definitely is the case for me, I think, as most of you know, like particularly the Tibetan Dzogchen teachings, I feel like are not actually something different than just sitting, but they're talking about it in a different way, and they're giving pointers from different angles. So to the point where I almost feel like looking back, this is, you know, just my own view of the current moment, is like I feel like I really didn't understand just sitting thoroughly until really delving into and hearing a lot of teachings and practicing them from the Dzogchen tradition. That may be kind of blasphemous, but I think it's my personal experience that for other people they maybe don't need that, right? But I feel like for me, that's what I would say now. And then someone might critique that and say, well, that's not really true because you just have the Dzogchen view of just sitting. That's not really just sitting. Your view is kind of warped. So it's hard to say, right? And maybe in the end it's not so much about defining shikantaza or some practice like that, but what is actually most freeing and most in the direction of openness and softness and wisdom and compassion. Yes.
You know, when I started finding this body meditation helpful, of course, I got curious about, well, you know, who is this guy and what's his path? And I just wanted to see, you know, where is he going with this? And I was so consolidated and pleased when, you know, basically he says, you know, once you get so that you can be settled in your body, then he says the best meditation I've found to then cultivate mindful awareness is Zen Shikantaza. I thought, oh, you know?
Yes. Yes.
I'm not going to totally go off and to some, you know, wrong land.
Yep.
That was so, like, beautiful and reassuring to me. So I'm learning how to calm myself down physically.
Yeah.
How to be able to be more present.
Mm-hmm.
But then I felt like, oh, good. And then there's nothing else I need to worry about.
Yeah, I think there's
Shikantaza.
There's a place.
Style.
Yeah. And where these traditions are really unified. So yeah, Reggie Ray is, you know, quite traditionally trained in all these Tibetan teachings from Trungpa Rinpoche and others, and tries to offer that. He puts a creative twist on things, but pretty traditional for an American Tibetan lineage teacher, as far as transmitting all the preliminary practices and so on. And I've heard that just recently he led a whole datun, which is like their practice period, on Shikantaza. And also Pema Chodron, who's also a Trungpa Rinpoche traditional nun, she once did a personal retreat at Green Gulch Farm for a few months. I went when I was living there, and people would come and bring her food and stuff, so they had some communication with her. She, up in the Hope Cottage up in the mountain. And we found out that the main text that she was working with on this long solo retreat was Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. not even like Dogen, but kind of the modern Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Maybe because she was at Green Gulch, but so we have all these ways. Yes.
Dharma gates are boundless, and
yes.
What I've become really curious about is people that are wandering the world that have no practice, that are practicing. You know what I mean?
They maybe wouldn't say it's a formal religious kind of practice.
That simply have clarity on their own.
Mm.
That don't follow a tradition, and I can't help but think that there are people out there that are wandering the world that are pretty darn awake. But it makes me curious to think of both other traditions as well as no traditions.
No traditions, yes. Yeah.
And just that there are people with such goodness. There are people that are so pure without practice, or at least without a formal practice. That they're practicing being how they are, and they hold that. They hold that Dharma position.
Yeah, so maybe some need it less than those who practice the formal traditions. And then, you know, then we can have, like, we can check all these situations out and really, for the sake of the complete awakening of all beings, we can interact and you know, come up with, I think we can maybe come up with criteria for authentic awakeness. It's a kind of dangerous thing to do that across traditions. I think it could be a dangerous thing, right? But that would we be willing to do that in the name of wanting complete awakening to pervade everywhere? Because if we don't, we just say, well, they seem nice, you know. But, you know, maybe when they're really pushed into a corner, they turn into something else or whatever. I think there's value in looking at what are the universal qualities of awakeness. Yes?
Vision, or just describing the vision, what you just said, just like this, one version is like, you know, they take two triangles, let's say we take ourselves as a center most of the time, right? So, me being in the center, being on top of a mountain, and maybe my teacher, some of my Dharma friends that I admire are higher than me, and everybody else is lower, you know, like, stuck in suffering. And then the other version is that I'm on the bottom of a big valley, and everybody is higher than me, you know? And then it's this pure perception realm of everybody is Buddha, no matter what they're doing. It's actually only me who's just not getting it.
Yeah. Nice.
And the switch that one can do, just visualizing it, just intrigues me, especially the one I'm kind of used to where I'm on top of it. But then to switch that over to now I'm on the bottom and everything, it gives a stimulus of do I really know what's going on? literally I don't, right? And to be related more to loose, to be more loose, and then those questions come up, exactly, because the perception is pure of maybe I'm not the right on everything and on top of everything and in control of everything.
Mm-hmm. So maybe even looking for these particular criteria is just for the sake of trying to refute someone's view and come out on top or something like that. Whereas also I think we could say awakeness could be a moment-to-moment thing. So we see somebody, random acts of kindness, right? We see awakened activity in the moment, wow, that person's pretty darn awake, right? And then, so the next moment, maybe not, but this is an awakened moment, or it's awake activity or expression, rather than there's a person who is always, you know, awake and never goes astray or something. Yes?
It seems Joyce and I go to the Peace United Church of Christ as well as our city here, that they, and I'm not sure how it's true, it's for them, Zen Center, is kind of what you're talking about, Chuck. A lot of people are not embracing formal religious traditions now, and yet there's a lot of goodness in the world that people manifest, and I wonder if there's any studies or any connections or any ways of interacting with folks that are not schooled or have broken free from that schooling and yet are still have some kind of practice, if there's any quantification or way of connecting with those kinds of people.
Yeah, sometimes the connections naturally develop, or such people find each other.
And what you're saying, of course, for so many people now, who may not be in the church but are online.
And using
that connection to restart something. Maybe even using that as a source in and of itself.
Yeah. I'm also reminded again of Katagiri Roshi with his, I think, wonderful analogy of that's a very nice car, but where's the gas? So, in other words, you have a whole built-up system and structure of dogma, but what's the practice, moment to moment? And that practice, that gas, it could be that the gas isn't even in a car. I mean, maybe that's stretching the metaphor now, but you just have this activity, and doesn't have to be in any particular vehicle.
No, the gas can become a truest.
Yeah, the gas is just
the open empty thing.
Yeah, the gas is just pouring over the earth, lubricating everything. Yes.
I remember quite a while ago hearing various people say, including you, that we sit to benefit all beings.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can barely wrap my mind around that. But then I look at that and I think about that and I think, well, yeah, but it doesn't stop there. The next step is then doing the same thing in your actions all the time. You're always trying to benefit others. And so I just got a little stuck with it. That, you know, just sitting, okay. But what about all the action in the world? You know, every interaction that you have, every person you connect with, every deed you do, how you put the practice in practice that way, you know, and I think that's kind of our role, is to step in the world and be doing what we think is best.
Yeah, moment to moment, all day, there's activity, often with others, and then I was thinking, and the other side too, is like, sometimes we spend days and days just sitting in the Zendo, right, and maybe that's sort of like to test that maybe it's easier to see how we're benefiting others when we're actually like helping them in some really tangible way. And we might say, and they're just sitting, yeah, we kind of know that, but like once in a while, we'll have like a whole week where just to make sure that we really can see. And this too, this like non-doing is like this greatly beneficial doing. Yeah, so we're benefiting all beings with this don't know mind at the same time, and that's quite hard because we might feel like, well, this is obviously benefiting beings and this obviously isn't, but that's where we can get stuck too, so that maybe that's another way to look at the Zazen, is helping us just drop off these ideas that this is definitely helpful and this definitely isn't, because this is how the world is. Yes, Caroline.
What everyone's been saying has brought to mind a powerful image for me of a series of moments in which there was an awakening together with people who were perhaps very unlikely to be able to communicate with each other across traditions. This took place, I don't know if I mentioned it before, in New Zealand, a few years ago, when I was welcomed with a group of other writers as part of a writers' festival by the Maori people, who on whose land we were holding our festival, and as they as the traditional owners and caretakers of that land, wanted to welcome us in and make sure that we would not bring anything alien or into their realm. So they brought us into their meeting house, which felt to me very much like Father Zendo. We sat on chairs while they chanted the elders, particularly the women, which was wonderful because they have such splendid voices. And at the end of the ceremony, we, the owners, lined up and we went in a procession to greet all of the Maori people who had welcomed us, and to touch noses and inhale breath, which is part of the greeting. And without thinking, I found myself, after touching noses, doing this. And to my surprise, our Maori host began to recognition there and a moment of, could I say, a sort of a shared awakening together. Yeah. And it was extraordinary. Yeah. I'll think of this the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's an example of a momentary experience of the thought we were talking about.
Yeah, I think there can be a shared awakenings, or shared openings, and maybe most of the time they're not in the realm of spoken language. Mm-hmm. Actually, that kind of like sort of breaks it down or creates divisions and dualism again.
Oh, and I should add that the Maori, as you know, are traditionally a very fierce warrior people, and at the same time there was such softness and welcoming in this ceremony afterwards. We had splendid afternoon tea in a very English fashion. Maori fish dishes added on. The thought that these people, in other versions of their way of being themselves, are warriors, was also very moving. So I think some kind of combination, as Letty was saying, of the robustness, the strength of our tradition, combined with the softness with which it may be practiced.
I just had the image just came to mind. I can't remember if this was something Suzuki Roshi said or something that someone said about him. But the image is regarding Suzuki Roshi is he had the front side of his body was like really kind of like open and really kind of like receptive and relaxed. And then when you'd see his back, it was always like bolt upright, apparently. So he had these two sides combined at the same time. Yes, Richard, last question. Comment.
And the first one wasn't Dogen, it was just the fellow traveling along who was glowing so much and said, I'm Buddha. For me, the story would have been more pleasant if he'd said, I'm Rilke. I'm nobody, whatever. Even a rustic, who might have a name. He didn't have to go beyond that. And the idea then that Dogen spoke of about the only way we agree to become practicing is that it's just one way from Buddha, who thought in a completely unique way and through his lineage. And that's why I said, we don't feel that way, really. We're not practicing that way. I mean, almost everyone that speaks gives me that sense. It makes me proud to be a part of the group because that's what I really think we feel. So maybe I don't agree with everything Dogen said. I would probably say I don't. Hmm.
Well, you say that it has to be this particular lineage.
Well, that it's been transmitted from through the ancestors. I don't think so. I think just like we said, I think pygmies and Maoris, and I could go on forever, And to me, the common thread is you start to find the authenticity and emptiness and mindfulness in people, whatever tradition or in a monastic setting, which means that they practice quietness. I found that the Christians, who had been in monasteries.
But it's not limited to that either. Right? And just to respond to you, just for fun, I think that's often how we hear when Dogen's talking about this, he says heir to heir and there's this entrustment. We usually think, he's talking about the Zen lineage. But in fact, strictly speaking, he didn't actually say that. Maybe he says it elsewhere. But we could also hear that as, it's not this particular Zen lineage of Buddhas and ancestors. Maybe we'd say that there's a transmission of the Maori ancestors too, but there's always a kind of like something's being passed along. And he's saying, let's not call it Zen. So maybe he's just emphasizing this hand-to-hand, face-to-face meeting that goes outside of Buddha Dharma. You know, maybe not, but I'm with you on seeing it that way. Yeah, and the other point about Buddha, just to think of that in a possible different way too, just to like play with it a little bit, like because I understand your point. Like he could have said, oh, "I'm just me," you know. But when I hear that story, I maybe sometimes think he's kind of glowing. I think the sutra maybe doesn't even say he's glowing, right? But I kind of embellish that. But maybe he's even glowing, and then we might think he says, "I am awake." But maybe we could hear it too. The person says, "Are you a person or a god or what are you?" And he's just walking along and says, "I'm just awake. I'm just awake today. How about you?" In a very non-exalted kind of way, right? "I'm just awake. I was sleeping before and I just woke up." I'm awake. I can't really say anything else. This is my experience right now. Is I feel like fresh and awake. My eyes are open. Maybe like that. And then it became the awakened one, Buddhism. Awakenism. The people who don't sleep. Okay. Thank you. So thanks for the conversation. Great to toss around some thoughts and expressions. And now in this particular strange tradition of awake, we do things like we like take the, you know, imagine that there's something like positive generated here, and then we like use our intentions to kind of like spread that to other beings who could use it. Is that true? Does it really have some effect like that? We don't know, but we don't care. I don't care so much. I'll just wholeheartedly do it with the intention that it does. So may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of awake way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them.